That also highlights why the clinical trials are so important, right? Because it is the gatekeeper for vaccines, for COVID treatments, so that it gets onto the patient, and for cancer treatments and everything else.
From Stanford University and SiriusXM, it's the future of everything. I'm Russ Altman, and today James Tso tells us about how AI is transforming healthcare. We focus on the challenges of having both providers and patients trust AI systems that are used for healthcare, and also how AI may help make clinical trials more equitable and efficient. It's the future of AI in healthcare. Artificial intelligence is increasingly used in many industries. We see it all over the internet as companies try to sell us stuff. We have it in our phones that we talk to, and they tell us the weather and our schedule. There are AI programs that figure out which movies we might like or what music we might enjoy. AI programs are increasingly being used in the financial sector to make investment decisions, process loan applications, and help with shipping and supply chain logistics. One area that has very high expectations for AI is healthcare. It could help clinicians make faster and more accurate diagnoses. It could help choose the best medications and monitor your response. It could be a second opinion on all of that after a physician makes the first opinion. It can already help drive robotic surgery, help manage critically ill patients, and make sure that patients receive appropriate preventive care. And it may also be able to help with the elderly and others who need help at home. But there are many barriers to the application of AI in healthcare. The primary one is, do we trust the programs and will they work better than our current all-human systems? AI programs today typically require lots of historical data in order to learn the patterns of what clinicians do in different situations. But the reliance on historical data means that there may be biases in how medicine is practiced, who gets to access the resources, and how outcomes are measured. So there's a huge issue of trust. Closely related to trust is the issue of privacy. The AI systems that are built require lots of data, and it may include our data. But what do you do if you don't want to be part of the system? Can your data be deleted? What if you want to opt out of having the AI system use your health data? It's one thing to delete it from a file, but what if they've already built the AI system using some of your data? What do they do then? Well, James Tso is a professor of biomedical data science and computer science at Stanford University, and he studies these issues. James, you trained in mathematics, statistics, computer science, and AI and machine learning. Why did you choose to focus on healthcare as a primary area for the application of your work?
Thank you, Russ. Really exciting to be here. I think biology and healthcare is really one of the most exciting applications of AI. Right. And from just developing algorithms perspective, it's such a rich area because the data is so interesting and so oftentimes very high dimensional, very noisy. Right. So it's great because it leads to a lot of interesting mathematical problems. We're thinking about dealing with like genomics data and medical imaging data, videos. In terms of the application's impact, I think it's also great, right? Because that's where I think a domain where AI could have some of the most direct and most impactful applications. Right, in both in terms of, you know, improving healthcare experience on the patient side, also in terms of more basic research and improving like drug discovery, the entire pipeline. So that's why I think this is really a great area, this intersection of AI and healthcare and medicine.
So of course, in choosing healthcare as an area, you have to take on some issues that are incredibly important. And I know people are, even in the lay press, there's been discussion about trustworthiness and bias. So I just wanted to start out, I know that you've worked on trust as a key issue. How would you define trust when you're thinking about computer programs and AI? And then how do we approach the issue of trust when it comes to deploying systems and getting both the providers, the healthcare providers, and the patients on board with all of this?
Yeah, I think that's a really important topic. I mean, trust is something that we all have a lot of experience with, right? If we get on an airplane, then we want to make sure that the plane is reliable, not, you know, 98% of the time, but essentially all the time. Right. Or if I, you know, want my car to be really reliable, so I can trust it when I take it across the different road trips. And I think it's a similar notion that's very understandable, similar notion of trust that we want to have for AI algorithms. Right. We want to ensure that these AI algorithms, it's not like they work only well when we're within the confines of Stanford. Right. It's that they work well across different settings. right, across diverse locations for diverse populations. So I think that's really an important notion of trust.
Do we know how to do this? So we're in a new age now where we're building these AI systems. They're based usually on large collections of data from the past that inform the program about what humans have decided to do and what the outcomes were. Do you feel like we're well situated to have these trustworthy systems, or could that be a showstopper in terms of deployment of these systems?
Yeah, so I think we've made a lot of progress. There's been a tremendous amount of progress in developing the AI methodology itself, right? To make the models more reliable. We're still not quite there yet, but there's been a lot of progress on the modeling side, right? I think where there still needs to be a lot more work to really to get to the level of trust that we want is more on the data pipeline side, right? Because one thing that we realize is that these AI models, right, could be very complicated, large neural networks, deep learning models, they're really good at picking up all sorts of things in the data, all sorts of potentially spurious correlations or artifacts in the data, right? Because they're so flexible and so powerful, right? So to really make sure that the models are trustworthy in across these diverse applications in healthcare, then we need to also have similar level of trust and quality control in what data that goes into feeding, to training and evaluating these models.
Yes, and it also raises the issue, I think, and I know you've done work in this area of regulation, like government bodies. So, yeah. You mentioned some really interesting examples earlier. You said that this could be a little bit like flying a plane where we have a lot of trust, or our car, and all of those are highly regulated. You know, we have the Federal Transportation Commission and et cetera, and we have building codes for buildings. So let me ask, the healthcare regulators, which is principally the FDA, but also some other governmental organizations, are they ready for AI? And do they know how to make sure that they can tell that a system is trustworthy, in your opinion? And if not, what needs to happen?
So I think that's a really interesting area. And that's an area where we're not quite there yet. Right? So I think there's still a lot of discussions about what is the proper way to even evaluate an AI system, let's say a medical AI system.
Yeah.
Right. So some of the work we did was actually looking at how medical AI systems were evaluated by the FDA before they were approved by the FDA to be used on patients. And it turned out that, for things like drugs or for vaccines, right, so FDA have a lot of experience in how to properly evaluate the safety of a COVID vaccine or the efficacy of drugs. But for AI systems, I think that raises a lot of new questions, and people just do not have a lot of experience, and FDA doesn't have a lot of experience in how to think about how to evaluate them, right? And that's just where I think there are some limitations in how medical AI systems are currently being evaluated by the FDA. A lot of those limitations come back to what is the data that's used, goes into evaluating these models. Do the data have sufficient coverage? Are the data have sufficient quality? Are they prospective data, right? So I think these are all questions that are not currently being finalized, but that's something that we need to do to ensure that these are properly evaluated and vetted.
Sure. And when you say coverage, I presume you mean along many dimensions. Like, we want to make sure there's good ethnic coverage for different ethnic groups, but also socioeconomic, maybe geographic. And so you can imagine a very complex analysis of, okay, this is the data we used, and we believe that it reflects the use scenarios where our programs will be used. And as far as I know, there's not an existing way to do that at the FDA or in many other agencies as well. And so it's going to be a partnership in, I guess, learning how to do it the right way and being very careful in the initial rollouts to make sure we don't make these big mistakes that set everything back, for many, many years because of a single bad outcome. I wanted to ask you about if you imagine, one of the things we have for a drug is that they do their best to prove that the drug is safe, but there's always a physician in the loop who's making the final decision typically with the patient about what drugs are going to be used and whether it's going to be stopped if we don't like the side effects. Do you imagine that these AI systems will have a similar partnership with humans, or do we imagine more automated systems?
Absolutely. I think that the AI systems should be designed in partnership with humans, because a lot of the way that they're being designed to be used, especially in medicine, is not to make sort of isolated decisions, but more as, for example, as a second readers providing additional opinions or to provide some feedback as a part of their overall clinical workflow. Right. So I think they do need to be designed in consideration of this entire workflow, which often includes other clinicians, physicians, maybe even other algorithms, as well as the patients. And I think that's actually one of the big limitations in currently how we, as an AI community, currently develops AI systems. So you think about how AI papers are written, NeurIPS happening right now. We have some papers there, and we also
this is the premier conference for artificial intelligence.
That's right. This is like the big conference, like this is the Super Bowl of artificial intelligence every year. Oftentimes, when we do this kind of machine learning or AI core AI research, right? So we often have a sandbox where we pick a particular data set, maybe some benchmark data sets like ImageNet, and we really try to develop the algorithm to optimize for the model's performance on that particular benchmark. Which sounds very reasonable, but if you take a step back, right, so that's actually very different from what we just described of the AI model actually working in combination or in collaboration with a team of humans, of physicians, or of the patients. And there are settings even, and we've seen some interesting experiments whereby improving the AI model's performance on a particular benchmark actually leads to worse overall effect onto this team.
Huh.
So maybe if you think about that AI's model's performance in the combination of the team, and if you measure the entire team's outcome, right, that actually is very different from just the improving the model by itself in isolation. So I think that's actually one of the biggest challenges, open challenges going forward with AI.
And it strikes me that this team approach with humans in the loop is also going to take pressure off having to be absolutely perfect in your proof that the system is working well and is not biased. And because when you have humans in the loop, they act as a buffer and as a kind of check on the AI system. So that helps me really understand how the FDA may initially want to see humans as part of a process to make initial approvals. And then, of course, if the system performs well and we hardly ever have to reverse it or whatever, then you can maybe give it more autonomy. So I think you're painting a very reasonable picture of a world where the AI system is integrated with the humans. And the point you just made where that's not always how the research is happening, that sounds like something that the research community is going to have to kind of grapple with and come up with new models.
I think that's right. Yeah, and you mentioned the FDA. I mean, I think that's something that would be great for the FDA to pay more attention to as well, because we actually went through over 100 of the FDA-approved AI algorithms, and very few of them, maybe only like 3 or 4, were evaluated in real time, right, in the context of a human team.
Right? Wow.
So that means that most of those other algorithms were evaluated on sort of static data, which is
reasonable. And yet they were approved.
Right. And I think the static evaluation have some limitations. Right? One big limitation is that it doesn't really capture, because it is static, it can't really capture the fact of this dynamics, right, of how the algorithm interacts with the human
right.
physician.
So this is great. This has been a great kind of landscape-setting conversation, but you yourself have done some really interesting work, and I want to make sure we talk about some of the findings and some of the technical things you've done. And one area of your focus has been clinical trials. Can you set up for us what you saw as the challenge? Because I think it's related to many of the things we've just been talking about. So what is the reason for your focus on clinical trials, and what are some of the most recent findings that you've had?
Yeah, so I think clinical trials, it's super important, right? It's really essentially like the big bottleneck for the entire medical translation process, right?
Yeah.
You think about all those great research that people are doing, right? There's a huge funnel whereby, out of thousands of research projects, only a few of them actually make it into the patients, right? Out of hundreds of potential drugs, only one of them actually make it to the patient.
Right.
And clinical trial is really both the gatekeeper and the bottleneck for this entire funnel.
And so just
that's
for people who don't
important.
Think, I'm sorry to interrupt, but for people who don't think about clinical trials, these are literally the trials where you give a new innovation to the patients. Usually there's a control group that doesn't get the innovation, and you then try to determine, does it work or does it not work? And it working is a necessary requirement to get approval and payment for the new innovation. So it really is the final check that a new technology is safe and ready for patient exposure. So forgive me. So please go on.
No, that's a great explanation of the great background. And that also highlights why the clinical trials are so important, right? Because it is the gatekeeper for vaccines, for COVID treatments so that it gets onto the patient, and for cancer treatments and everything else. The trials are also it's really complicated to design, which is why I think it could be really impactful for AI to help us to design these trials to make them more inclusive and more efficient. I think currently the way these trials are designed are often not very efficient and overly restrictive. Right? So what I might mean by that is that if you look at a clinical trial, a typical trial, they will often have tens of pages of rules to say that these patients are not eligible, they're excluded from this trial. Right? So for example, if my maybe white blood cell count is above some range, right, then I'm excluded. Or if I had a previous medical history of some disease, then I'm excluded. Right? So they just list all these rules for excluding patients. And oftentimes the effect of that is that a lot of patients, right, especially minority patients, older patients, right, patients from different socioeconomic backgrounds, are just not included in these clinical trials. They're not even eligible. And the flip side of this is that the patients that end up in the clinical trials are often what's considered like the Olympic athletes of the patients. Right? They're like, among the people who have this disease, right, they're the extremely healthy version of those. And that has several important consequences for all of us. Right? So the first thing that means is that how well a treatment works on these Olympic athletes of patients may not reflect how well they work on you and me. Right? Mm-hmm. Because,
we might not be Olympic athletes, just to state it simply.
We may not be Kobe Bryant. And the second thing is that, so that sort of affects the generalization, right, the generalizability and the trustworthiness of the treatment, going back to our point. The second thing is that also potentially makes these trials and drug development just hugely expensive, right? Because now, like, from all these patients, you have to find these very specific patients, right? The patient recruitment, if you for clinical trials, it's very expensive. On average, it costs over tens of thousands of dollars to just recruit one patient for, let's say, for oncology, for a cancer trial.
And they often need thousands of patients.
And they also need to screen thousands of patients. Right? So on both sides of the development, both from the public user's perspective, also from the drug developer's perspective, the current process is hugely inefficient and potentially very biased. Right? So that just really motivates us to say, can we actually use the AI algorithms combined with these very large world, real world data sets coming from electronic health records to help us design clinical trials, right, to make the process more efficient and potentially much more inclusive.
Next, we will hear about how James uses AI techniques to approach all these challenges in designing and running clinical trials on SiriusXM Business Radio, channel 132. We're back with Professor James Tsou. And James, at the end of the last segment, you were describing all of these challenges for clinical trials. You established that they're incredibly important for advancing medicine, and yet they're expensive. There are issues of the Olympic patient and leaving out many of the regular people. And that leads to obvious issues of the relevance of any study to all of the patients who might be interested in the treatment. So tell me, what have you done to try to begin to solve some of these problems?
Yeah, so we developed this tool. It's a computational platform called Trial Pathfinder, which is a collaboration with Roche, Genentech, one of the largest biopharma companies. And the goal of Trial Pathfinder is it provides a computational tool to help us design clinical trials using real-world data, basically data from medical records. Right, so the intuition of this is that if you look at the medical records, right, there are a lot of patients that end up taking these treatments even if they're not eligible to participate in the clinical trial in the first place. Right? I mean, the trial was done on these Olympic athletes, but the ones that drugs are approved by the FDA, then it's used much more broadly by all these other patients. Right? And we have records of all those patients. Then that's super helpful because that helps us to essentially ask the counterfactual question of what would this trial have looked like if we had relaxed the trial criteria and allowed these additional patients to enroll in the trial in the first place, right? Because we have their medical records and we have the outcomes.
And you might you even know whether the drug worked or not, or if it's a drug.
Exactly. So since we follow them over time, over many years, we know, did the drug work? Right? Did they have adverse events? And that's great. So, and that's really the motivation, the secret sauce for this trial pathfinder. So it's this computational framework that look at hundreds of thousands of patients. And using that, it's basically computationally generates millions of synthetic clinical trials, right? Each of these synthetic clinical trials sort of computationally changes right? The rules for including or excluding patients, right? So adjust these different rules. And then it's all done computationally, so no real patients is harmed. Right?
So just to be clear, you're using the word synthetic because it's almost like pretend, but it's not totally pretend because it's based on real data that you've pulled from the electronic medical records. And then you can do computational experiments to run plausible trials thousands or millions of times and see what happens.
Exactly. That's right. So it's using the real world data from real patients to computationally simulate what the trial would have looked like to make these very realistic trials. Right?
Do you have to know the results on these patients in order for this to be a useful tool? Because sometimes a drug company may come with a brand new drug that never has been given to other people because it hasn't been released yet. Can you still help them in these cases where it's an entirely novel treatment? Or is it more for the follow-on studies after an initial approval?
That's a great question. So even for entirely new treatment, oftentimes there are previous treatments on the market that are similar, right? Maybe someone will come up with a new checkpoint inhibitor, and then we have like this five other checkpoint inhibitors that have similar mechanisms. So there's still data from the past that can help us to inform the design of new treatments.
Great. Yeah, so you're borrowing information, even if it's only partially relevant, but it can inform your studies. So can you give me an example? I don't know if maybe this is still privileged information, but are there any publicly able to be discussed publicly examples of using this technology to make a trial more efficient or more effective?
Yeah. So we actually use this to study a bunch of cancer trials. Because cancer trials are especially difficult to design, more complex and more expensive. And we're particularly looking at, let's say, advanced non-small cell lung cancer, so a relatively common kind of cancer type, especially in the US. And what we found is that using Trials Pathfinder, right, to help us design those trials, we could actually more than double the number of eligible patients for those trials while still actually improving the outcome of the patients. So I think that's really a win-win for both sides. It helps the patients, also helps the trial company. And also importantly, that also enables a lot more patients, like minorities and older patients who were previously excluded, to now to be eligible to participate and to get these cutting edge treatments.
And so I assume that you found that these additional patients that you were able to synthetically recruit, they came from these populations that had previously been underrepresented, which is exactly the problem you pointed to in the beginning.
That's exactly right.
Great. Well, I want to move, and we have a few minutes remaining. You wrote a paper that has a great title, and that's why I'm asking you about it. It was called Making AI Forget You. And that is something that I think all of us think about every now and then as we're bombarded with advertisements and emails, and our social media kind of explodes with things that are clearly related to other searches or things that we have done on the internet, thus making it very clear that this information is being shared widely. And so when you write a paper called Making AI Forget You, it kind of got my attention right away. So can you tell me what was the setup for that paper and what did you do in it?
Yes. I think we all have experience of where maybe we want to delete our Facebook account or we want to delete our Twitter account. But the question is, now, after I delete my Facebook or Twitter account, right, how do I know that my information has really been deleted?
Yeah.
And that's both practically but also important from a policy perspective, because these data regulations like GDPR in Europe and also regulations in the US stipulates that we as consumers can tell companies to delete our data. Now, if I think about data just sitting on a static table, like there's a row on my table that corresponds to James So, one row for Russ, right? Then that's pretty easy. I just click and delete that row in the table. The complexity is now if that table has been trained and been looked at by an AI algorithm, right, a very powerful algorithm, then even if I delete that row in the table, right, the algorithm might still remember enough information about me to be able to reconstruct my medical history or reconstruct my browser history.
Right.
So that's motivated our work, is to see how can we actually delete data from the AI model that's been trained on our personal information.
And I would presume that if you did do that, it might adversely impact the performance of the AI model. Is that true?
Yes. So if a lot of people decide to delete their data, right, from Twitter, and if the Twitter's algorithms actually do have to remove those individuals' data, right, then the algorithm could get worse.
And I guess the model would be that in general, it'll be a small percentage of people, and hopefully it won't well, I don't even know what to hope for, but presumably it won't kill the performance as long as it's a relatively small numbers. How did you do this? So do you just recalculate the model without that data, or are there more sophisticated ways to do it so you don't have to start from scratch?
Yeah, so actually what people often do in practice is to simply retrain the model from scratch based on the remaining data without the data that's being deleted.
Yeah.
Right. And that it's really not practical for the large AI models, right? Just in terms of the energy cost, the climate change cost itself, right? If we have to retrain the model every time someone deletes their Twitter account, then that would just be astronomical. So one of the solutions we came up with is basically very efficient ways to delete someone's data from a model without having to retrain the model on the remaining data points.
Great. And in the last minute, I think this relates to other work that you've done, which is the value of data. And I know you've written kind of theoretical and applied papers about how to look at a data set and know which of those data points are the most valuable. And this seems to relate to this issue of the deleting data, because you may delete my data, and if I'm a very average person, maybe nobody cares because the model's not going to change. But if my data was particularly important for helping the model perform well, then it might really change the model a lot. So in the last 47 seconds, can you tell me a little bit about the information analysis of how that not all data is equal?
Right. And what we find often in practice is that not all data, some data are much more important than others, right? Maybe if you have a rare disease, like your medical records, your genetic information is much more useful than my genetic information. And I think that also leads to this broader discussion about, what's the right way to think about even compensating individuals or compensating patients, right, for the value of their data? And how do we give individuals more agency over how their data is being used, right? Because people's data are extremely useful, and that's what all the AI is being built on top of.
Thanks to James So, that was the future of AI in healthcare and the future of data privacy. I'm Russ Altman, and this is The Future of Everything on SiriusXM Business Radio, channel 132.